Hello, and welcome to the 8th episode of Season 8 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Now, there's one story that's been dominating the AML world this past month.
Well, yes, Ray, NatWest and the story of their relationship with Fowler Oldfield. We covered this story originally back in the spring 2021, when news of the prosecution first emerged, didn't we?
We did, Graham, but now more information has emerged.
Well, yeah, I'd say so, Ray. The FCA's published a 100-odd page statement of facts that detail the systems and the failures within NatWest at each point in the relationship. NatWest has pled guilty to the criminal charge and it's been issued with a fine of £265 million.
Yes, that's about the size of it, Graham.
So, right, I imagine that people are expecting us to lay into NatWest somewhat.
Yes, I expect so. And while we are going to, Graham, I think the story is a bit more nuanced than that. Based on a close reading of the statement of facts, there's actually an awful lot that NatWest got right, or at least tried to. And we're going to look at this issue along with the HSBC fine that came hot on its heels.
Well, that's an interesting comparison, Ray. I'm sure everyone in our community seems just to have piled on, well, both of them this week.
Well, that's a fair observation, Graham. I mean, look, NatWest and HSBC haven't covered themselves in glory here. But in most respects, I think a lot of firms ought to be reflecting that they're but for the grace of God.
Okay, you've previewed our position here, and I think we owe our listeners a balanced review of the case, giving credit where it's due and criticism where that might be indicated.
That's fair, Graham. I think it's also worth looking at the way these cases exemplify the real challenges that many firms will be facing in meeting their AML obligations, even today. Because it's very easy to pick out the more sensational elements of the carefully considered NatWest statement of facts and present this as a complete omni-shambles that could never happen to us. And that would be to miss an opportunity to reflect and learn.
And we like to reflect and learn, don't we, Ray? So that sounds like it'll be worth a listen. Mm-hmm. Shall we start then with some basic facts?
Yes. Do you want to kick us off on that, Graham?
Well, I would be happy to. Ray, in 2011, NatWest acquired a new client. Hooray. And this was Fowler Oldfield, ostensibly a gold dealer, a buyer and seller of that precious metal, based in Bradford in the north of England. They'd been active in that business for over a century, and in the 5 years following onboarding, Fowler Oldfield deposited about £365 million, of which £264 million was in cash.
In 2016, the police raided Fowler Oldfield and a connected business in London.
And that connection brought in a certain, he's going to say this carefully, Mr. James Stunt, the son-in-law of former Formula One boss Bernie Eccleston. In all, 13 individuals were arrested in connection with money laundering offences.
The investigation began in 2017 into NatWest's role in affairs, the implication being that it had failed in meeting its legal responsibilities in overseeing the financial crime risks of this client. In early 2021, the bank was formally charged with crimes under the UK money laundering regulations.
And so the bank says, guilty, m'lud, signs off on the published mea culpa, pays its fine and braces for the critical headlines and the op-eds while assessing the considerable challenge of restoring its reputation.
A big job, you'd think. So, let's look at what they tried to do and what they got wrong. And I think we should look separately at four separate aspects of the piece.
Okay, so what are they, Ray?
Well, first, the onboarding, the way the client became an approved customer of NatWest. Then the routine oversight of the account during its operation, which is to say the systems, controls and people that were managing the financial crime risk. Thirdly, I think we should look at the escalation and investigation processes when alerts were sounded. And then fourthly, I think we should look at how change was handled.
Well, that sounds very good. Also, I've got to say, it sounds like a really long episode.
Well, you're right, of course, Graham, and this is going to be at least a two-parter.
Okay, so let's start with the onboarding then. The relationship manager had to overcome some, well, reluctance from the bank to get this client taken on in the first place, didn't he?
Yes, Graham. It's clear that this was rightly seen as a prospective client from a higher risk industry. And it was only when the relationship manager stressed that cash management would not figure in the relationship that the client was approved.
And even then, there was a condition imposed, if I read this correctly. The relationship manager was to remain close to the account to ensure that transactions were as expected and to review the case in 6 months to ensure the account was operating as anticipated.
Yes, that's right. But unfortunately, that control failed fairly quickly.
How so, Ray?
Well, the day after the account was opened, Fowler Oldfield was registered on the bank's back office record system for Business Quick Deposit. Now, that's a product which allowed customers to deposit cash into their accounts, potentially via an automated drop box and without necessarily engaging with a NatWest branch employee.
Cash wasn't supposed to be part of this relationship, though, was it?
No, and nor was there any mention of them needing this service in the account opening process. And they didn't use the facility at all for 2 years.
Nonetheless, the service was enabled from the start, perhaps, I guess, through an administrative mistake, which allowed it later to be used, despite this high-risk client's acceptance by the bank as a non-cash customer.
Yes. And there's no evidence of the six-month review taking place either.
Because it doesn't mean it didn't happen, Ray, just that no one made a note of it, they didn't record it, or if they did make a record, that we haven't got it anymore.
No, absolutely, Graham. But as we often say, if it's not recorded, it didn't happen.
Even if it did.
That's right. But let's reflect on what's happened here. A potential new client was identified and escalated for onboarding approval, which was initially declined, then approved with conditions after the relationship manager had assembled more information, some of which turned out not to be accurate.
And the case was agreed to represent a high risk of financial crime. The relationship manager stressed the absence of cash management, which would serve to mitigate the overall risk. He made some assertions about the client's standing with Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs that were not true. But whether these assertions were made initially by him or by Fowler Oldfield to him isn't known. The approver was swayed, however, but was still cautious and set two conditions for onboarding, which reflected that caution and should have controlled the risk quite effectively.
Yes, there was a lot of good practice here. But.
Yes, but some of the facts, in inverted commas, that supported the application were not factual. There is no evidence of the conditions being met, and right at the start, the firm was given access to cash facilities that should have been beyond their reach.
Indeed, the bank had effective controls that simply weren't properly or fully operated by staff.
And as we now know, the effect was to facilitate an extensive criminal operation that one commentator has dubbed the Bradford Laundromat.
Yeah, and that's a fair moniker, I'd say.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, that's the onboarding stage. On to the ongoing monitoring then. Remember that this was a high-risk account, so we would expect enhanced monitoring, right?
Yes, absolutely. More frequent periodic reviews, perhaps more stringent limits to trigger transaction monitoring alerts and event-driven reviews, things of that nature.
And NatWest did have systems set up to deliver these things, presumably.
Yeah, kind of. They did, yes, to an extent. But there were issues with their execution, shall we say.
Okay. What kind of issues?
Well, if we take periodic and event-driven reviews as our example, the bank from the earliest days of this relationship had quite detailed policy and procedural requirements for these. As a high-risk client, Fowler Oldfield required at least an annual review, and there was a good definition of the sorts of things that should prompt an event-driven review as well. In later years, there were further iterations of policy and guidance, but the core requirements weren't affected.
Well, that sounds like good practice.
Well, here it was more a case of theory than practice, Graham.
Oh, that is so often the case, Ray, isn't it?
It is, sadly. Let me quote from the statement of facts at this point to illustrate the variance between theory and practice. As Fowler Oldfield was rated high risk, the bank's periodic review policy dictated that it should have been subject to a periodic review in November 2012, 1 year into the relationship. This review did not occur. There is no recorded reason for why it was not completed. Fowler Oldfield was not subject to any periodic reviews during the lifetime of the customer relationship.
No periodic reviews at all, Ray?
That's what it says here, Graham.
Well, maybe they happened, but the records were lost or they were misfiled.
Well, I don't think so, Graham. Remember, this is an agreed statement of fact. NatWest put their name to this, and it says quite clearly, quote, Fowler Oldfield was not subject to any periodic reviews during the lifetime of the customer relationship. Whereas elsewhere, the language is there is no record of, or whatever.
Hmm, and that wouldn't have happened by chance, would it?
No.
So that is pretty significant. What about event-driven reviews?
There were two. One of those followed a change in directors.
Okay, but it wasn't immediate, was it?
Right. No.
The statement of facts describes a 15-month gap, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Graham, but it also describes in that review a documented picture of the firm and the relationship that was significantly at odds with reality, as evidenced by the bank's own records.
So the decisions that resulted from the review could never be the right ones because they relied on inaccurate information.
No, absolutely. After the initial 2 year period where there was no cash being handled, that tap was turned on. And this should have represented a pressing need for review.
And was there one?
Well, not as such. There was an alert and it was referred to the relationship manager. But his response was, and I'm quoting again here, cash volumes are very much in line with our expectations for this type of business.
Despite the fact that no cash was supposed to have been involved?
Quite so, Graham. This seemed to settle the matter and there was no event-driven review.
Okay, so what did trigger the second review then?
This came in March 2016 and coincided with Fowler Oldfield being returned to high-risk status.
I'm sorry, returned to high-risk status?
Yeah. You see, it seems that in late 2013, the client was reclassified as part of a remediation programme from high-risk to, well, low-risk.
Oops. Do we know why?
Well, not entirely, Graham. It seems that at some point the nature of Fowler Oldfield's business activity was changed on the system from precious metals, which it had been, to wholesale metals and metal ores. And that, combined with the low risk factor of location in the UK, may have led to the re-rating, but the bank isn't able to say definitively how this happened.
But that description of their business, just it's not accurate.
Well, indeed. Nonetheless, the relationship manager amended the risk rating in April 2014, noting the high level of cash activity.
Excellent. Back up to high.
Medium, Graham.
Medium.
Yeah. Which is where it remained for 2 years, which is a shame, really, because in 2013-14, the bank had a special file remediation exercise for all high-risk customers in which the Fowler Oldfield case didn't participate. When that exercise began, Fowler Oldfield was a high-risk client and should have been in scope. But by the time the exercise finished, it was no longer rated high risk, so presumably was excluded on these grounds.
Well, that just seems a shame in retrospect.
Mm.
So, well, what was going on with the transaction monitoring all this time? The bank did have transaction monitoring systems in place, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely, it did.
Which should, you'd think, have raised alerts in terms of the increasing cash activity.
Well, yes, fair point. But actually, the cash deposits weren't visible to the transaction monitoring system.
I think you need to say that again, Ray.
Okay, let me put it slightly differently. The transaction monitoring system didn't know about the cash deposits, Graham.
Okay, how did that happen?
Well, it seems that as far as the transaction monitoring system was concerned, these were checks, not cash.
Really?
Yeah. This came to light in 2014 and 2015, when internal SARs led to investigations. And the investigators noted each time that deposits recorded as checks were, in fact, cash. Now, those two discoveries came a full year apart, but nothing happened, as far as we can see, either time.
Well, I'm staggered, Ray.
And a third opportunity came in 2016, when a transaction monitoring manager separately identified the mislabeling of cash entering through the direct cash product as check deposits.
You'd have thought the clue was in the product name, right? Mm. I mean, it is called direct cash.
Well, it's obvious to us, Graham, but not to the machines at the time.
Okay, so the machine couldn't see excessive cash throughput, but it could see excessive check throughput. Wasn't that an alerting issue?
At some points during the relationship, yes. At others, no. The statement of facts devotes quite a large section to the evolution of transaction monitoring rules during the key years.
And what's the overall flavour of that, Ray?
Well, it's clear that the bank were trying to become more responsive to the kinds of risks they were seeing. There were new rules being introduced, partly from a realisation that the corporate business had, at the start, very few rules in place. But volumes were an ongoing issue.
Volumes are always an ongoing issue, Ray.
Well, yeah, but things seem to have come to a head in this period. In early 2013, there was an internal report on corporate transaction monitoring that concluded that not all areas of the corporate division were being effectively monitored by the automated system. That monitoring suffered due to poor or missing account and product information, that the system didn't take risk rating into account, that customer account segregation and the application of rules was inadequate, that there was no regular assurance review, no regular review or update of settings, no business or technology documentation, not enough engagement from the business, and that there were capacity constraints with the current monitoring platform.
Is that all?
There's a bit more. Also, it observed that there was no process for ongoing review and evaluation of the data going into the bank's automated transaction monitoring system, or review of the effectiveness of rules and coverage. And nor had there been since 2008 or 2009. Now, that is it. That's all now.
Thank you. And as we'll see, that there are distinct similarities here with the HSBC findings. Mm. But what was the NatWest response to this?
Well, following that 2013 internal report, there was a review, Graham, that concluded with 16 new rules being introduced over the course of 2013. Three of them would have applied to Fowler Oldfield. And this is difficult, because each of those was switched off again in mid-2014. There were new rules added in 2015 that would have alerted Fowler Oldfield cash and check stuff, but many of these rules were deactivated just 4 months later.
Well, that just seems a shame, right?
Yeah, especially since those rules had been specifically added in 2015 to increase coverage of cash risks in the corporate division.
Okay, I think we've just moved beyond "that seems a shame."
Nicely put. And we also find more rules being deactivated in 2016, which seems to have been for reasons of capacity.
Does that mean that they were generating more alerts than they could handle?
Well, that's the implication. Technology limitations meant that those investigating SARS could only work 6,500 cases a month, but they were getting 9,000 a month based on systems alerts.
So they scaled up the operation.
Well, no, they didn't. They looked at which rules had historically led to the fewest SARS being filed and turned those rules off.
Well, that's one way to apply a risk-based approach, I suppose.
Well, yeah. One of the rules that was binned was the one for large check deposits. So even this miscategorised activity would no longer raise alerts. And the upshot is that at least £151 million of Fowler Oldfield's cash deposits were misclassified as cheque deposits at a time when rules that would have alerted on large cheque deposits either didn't exist or were switched off.
This is going to be an unusual thing for me to say, but I am actually running out of words to express how I feel about this, Ray.
Well, I know what you mean. Now, as well as the rules-based system, and we know there are limitations to rules-based systems, NatWest also had in place a profiling tool called the Security Blanket that compared activity on an account with its historical activity and peer group activity to detect unusual behaviour.
Well, we all need a security blanket, don't we? That sounds good.
It does, Graham. Now, the rules were designed to be tuned by the Financial Crime Transaction Monitoring and Screening team in the group's services function. Tuning involved reviewing the rules to ensure their efficacy and efficiency. And in the NatWest documentation, that was said to have been essential to its effective operation.
Yes.
Yeah. The security blanket was not tuned between 2008 and 2016.
Oh, 8 years. I mean, what's that? But in any case, it presumably saw all the cash as checks anyway.
Well, indeed so.
Now, we're going to look separately at the escalation of what alerts there were, but before we leave transaction monitoring, I want to go back to a couple of points I heard summarised in the internal report you mentioned a minute or two ago.
Okay.
Now, first, you said that one of the findings of the 2013 report was that the system didn't take risk rating into account.
Yes, that's right. Prior to the new rules that were introduced in April 2016, there were no additional specific rules for high-risk customers.
But why not? You'd think that the requirement for enhanced monitoring would require special rules or limits to be put in place.
Yeah, and the bank knew this was a problem. In 2013, they asked for and received a policy exception, because they felt that their current systems would not allow them to meet the policy's commitment to do this effectively.
And what happened then?
Well, eventually, somehow, it became clear that their existing system could actually do this. The exception was withdrawn in 2014, and in 2016, new rules were introduced that could respond to the particular client's risk rating.
Okay, I see. The other point that caught my attention was the one about there not being enough engagement from the business. What was the job of the business here, Ray, in relation to transaction monitoring?
Well, as you know, Graham, the business is responsible for maintaining the client KYC information. It's the primary interpreter and arbiter of alerts as well.
Yeah, because an alert needs to be reviewed in context. Someone who knows the client and the account activity needs to determine whether what's going on is explicable as legitimate activity or if there are questions to be answered.
And this does require the business to approach alerts with an open and inquiring mind.
And is this what happened here, Ray?
Not so much, Graham. As we'll see when we come to look at escalations, the relationship manager's position seems at every turn to seek to comfort inquirers and to share his own comfort with what was going on. often activities that to a neutral observer were clearly not in line with the documented purpose of the account and nature of the client's business, were strongly defended by the relationship manager as within expectations.
But Ray, neutral observer is surely what we would want the relationship manager to be here, isn't it?
You'd think so, Graham, but the relationship manager was fairly consistent in knocking back alerts and escalations, apparently without too much in the way of reflection.
I note that he was eventually fired, Ray.
Yeah, once the damage had been done. But there is some interesting language in the statement around this that I want to come back to next time, because there are a few linguistic aspects of the statement, some of which we've touched on already, that are worth considering.
Well, now I'm just intrigued, right?
Well, you'll have to wait, Graham. For now, though, it's worth noting that the statement speaks of an over-reliance on and or failure to sufficiently challenge explanations provided by the relationship manager. And to be fair to them, the bank's own internal investigations had identified this too.
Okay, then. I think we've presumed on our listeners' patience enough for one episode. We've looked at the first two areas of focus in the statement of facts. So next time, it's escalations and recognising changes. Is that right?
Yes, it is, as well as picking at two particular loose threads. One we've already talked about, which is the analysis of some of the language in particular parts of the statement.
And what's the other?
Well, we might want to zoom out slightly, Graham, and look at some of the other aspects of the Bradford Laundromat itself. What do we know about who was involved and what they were actually doing?
And will Scottish banknotes feature in that, Ray?
It's highly possible, Graham.
And either next time or possibly in a third episode, we'll bring in HSBC as well and see what learning we can derive from all of this.
I'm looking forward to it.